Welcome to Podcast Against Antisemitism, the show that takes a deep dive into the world's oldest hatred. I'm Ellie, your host, and you can join us for new episodes every Thursday. Subscribe now at antisemitism.org/podcast or wherever you get your podcasts to make sure you never miss a show. You can also watch the podcast on our YouTube channel. And please consider leaving us a nice review so we can grow our listenership. It makes a big difference. My guest today is Congressman Richie Torres, the U.S. representative for New York's 15th congressional district covering the Bronx. At 25, he became the youngest elected official in New York City and the first openly LGBTQ plus elected official from the Bronx. Congressman Torres has repeatedly spoken out against antisemitism, both in his home of New York City and also around the world. Congressman Torres, thank you so much for being here. How are you doing?
It's an honor to be here. Thank you for having me.
Well, thank you. And now, look, as many of our listeners will know, you have been extremely vocal on the issue of antisemitism, which I think comes as a welcome surprise to many Jews, given the fact that you yourself are not Jewish. And frankly, it's sad to say, but it's rare to have allies as strong as you have consistently been. Why have you been so consistently vocal about antisemitism? And do you recognize that this isn't really the norm?
Well, you know, one need not be Jewish to condemn antisemitism any more than one need be black to condemn anti-black racism. You know, I operate under the belief that we all have a moral obligation to fight extremism, no matter what form it takes. I'm reminded of a quote from Dr. Martin Luther King, who said that the greatest tragedy, history will record that the greatest tragedy is not the strident clamor of the bad people, but it's the appalling silence of the good people. And at a time of rising anti-Semitism, we're all confronted with a simple moral choice. Either we remain appallingly silent, or we speak out. Either we remain part of the problem, or we become part of the solution. And I feel deeply that I have a moral obligation to speak out and to be part of the solution. And I do have critics who claim that I speak out too often against anti-Semitism. But the problem is not that I speak out too often. The problem is that society does not speak out often enough. And, you know, there were Jews like Andrew Goodman and Michael Schwerner who were murdered during the Mississippi burning so that people who look like me can have the right to vote and can live freely in the United States of America. So the obligation to fight extremism does not come from one's particular identity. It comes from our common humanity.
Yeah, I think that's fantastic. And as I'm sure you are no doubt aware, reports of anti-Semitism, as you say, have been increasing with the most recent FBI hate crime statistics revealing that anti-Semitic incidents comprised 51.4% of religious-related incidents in the United States, despite the Jewish population making up less than 3% of the country's population. Why do you think this is, and what do you think the country needs to do in order to combat this rise?
Well, as you've noted, the statistics are alarming. You know, according to the FBI, more than half of religiously motivated hate crimes specifically target the Jewish community. So there's certainly been a tidal wave of anti-Semitism that has swept American society, British society, and elsewhere in the world. You know, one of the forces that drives anti-Semitism is history itself. History is destiny. And there is a long and ugly history of scapegoating Jews for whatever pathologies might affect a particular society at a particular point in history. And we see that scapegoating rear its ugly head, sometimes against the Jewish community, sometimes against the state of Israel. And we have to speak out against it. We as a society have to commit ourselves to proactively condemning anti-Semitism wherever and whenever and from whomever it emerges.
I want to ask you about your city in particular. According to police data, New York City saw 263 anti-Semitic attacks in 2022, which translates as one attack every 33 hours on average. as both a congressman and also a resident of New York, what are you thinking when you hear this?
Look, New York City is supposed to be a cosmopolitan city where everyone is welcome, where more than 200 languages are spoken. And I consider the prevalence of anti-Semitic attacks to be a stain on the soul of our city, to be a moral indictment. You know, Franklin Roosevelt spoke of freedom from fear. And I would submit to you that wherever there is fear, there can never be freedom. And there are Jews, Hasidic Jews, pro-Israel Jews, who live in fear of violence. And all of us have a human right to live freely without fear of intimidation and harassment and violence. And those, you know, whether you're Jewish or not, we all have an obligation to be the Maccabees of the modern world and to defend the right of Jews to live freely without fear of anti-Semitic violence.
Yeah. Yeah, I love it. You touched upon Israel there. You've repeatedly spoken out about the demonization of Israel and anti-Zionist forms of anti-Semitism. Now, recently, you, in addition to Campaign Against Anti-Semitism and other Jewish groups, you called out a BBC journalist who said that Israel is, quote, happy to kill children. You rightly labeled it as a modern incarnation of the medieval blood libel. And after complaints from us and others, an apology was given by the BBC. What are your thoughts on how media portrayals of Israel in the West can affect real-life anti-Semitism?
Well, I find that the media is part of the problem rather than part of the solution. You know, there's a moral distinction between the killing of combatants and the killing of civilians. There's a moral distinction between the unintentional killing of civilians and the intentional killing of civilians. And I find that those distinctions are blurred when it comes to both mainstream media and social media coverage of Israeli military operations. You know, I often draw a distinction between a-Zionism and anti-Zionism. You know, if you're an a-Zionist, you might be apathetic about Israel as a Jewish state. And you're entitled to be apathetic. Not everyone has to be committed to Israel as a Jewish state. But if you're anti-Zionist, then you're not merely apathetic, you're actively antagonistic toward the existence of Israel as a Jewish state. And I find that that active antagonism often rises to the level of anti-Semitism. I find that anti-Zionism in the real world often rises to the level of anti-Semitism. And, you know, one clear-cut example is the BBC anchor who casually said that Israel is happy to kill children, which to me is a modern manifestation of the medieval blood libel. And we know that the blood libel has a long and ugly history of provoking anti-Semitic violence. In fact, one of the founding fathers of Zionism, Moses Hess, was so affected by the Damascus affair, the blood libel in Damascus in 1840, that it motivated him to write Roman Jerusalem, which proposed the concept of a Jewish state and which served as a precursor to Theodor Herzl's Jewish state, which is the seminal text of Zionism. So the origins of Zionism are bound up with the experience of anti-Semitism, which was often incited by the blood libel.
Yeah. Why do you think that so often the modern incarnation of the blood libel goes unchecked? Why do you think people feel free to sort of repeat it? Is it something they just don't realize is anti-Semitic?
Casual anti-Semitism permeates our culture so deeply that it appears even under the guise of objective journalism. You know, I have found that Israel is often a blank slate on which anti-Semitic conspiracy theories and tropes are projected. And, you know, the blood libel is a classic example of an anti-Semitic trope, whether it's directed against a Jewish individual or the Jewish community or the Jewish state, which happens to be the largest Jewish community in the world. But we as a society often turn a blind eye to anti-Semitic conspiracy theories and tropes when those tropes are directed against the Jewish state rather than the Jewish community.
Hey, if you want to stay up to date with the fight against anti-Semitism, why not subscribe to Campaign Against Anti-Semitism? Visit antisemitism.org/act or follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, or YouTube. Now, I want to move on. I want to ask you about the IHRA definition, the international definition of anti-Semitism, which you have referred to in the past as the gold standard. It is endorsed widely in the Jewish world, and we at CAA have worked hard to make the UK government the first in the world to adopt the definition. And since then, it has been adopted by national governments worldwide and a multitude of states and local authorities in the United States. But it still faces some resistance. In your opinion, why do you think some politicians might be reluctant to embrace the definition?
Well, I not only accept, but I embrace the IHRA definition as the most complex definition of a complex phenomenon that is anti-Semitism. And it ought to command universal acceptance. You know, I find that the attempt to discredit the IHRA definition is based more on a caricature rather than a fair characterization of the IHRA definition. So the critics of IHRA would have you believe that the IHRA definition inhibits all criticism of Israel. And I would have a few responses. First, if you think that society is inhibiting criticism of Israel, I want to know what planet you're on. I also want to know what you're smoking. So that's one, because I don't recognize the world that you're describing. I see no evidence of an inhibition of criticism of Israel. Quite the opposite. If there's any country that's the target of more vicious, vehement criticism, it's the state of Israel. And second, yeah, the IHRA definition explicitly states that criticism of Israel is not anti-Semitic. And my view is, you know, it's criticism of every country, including Israel's, fair game. You know, criticism of Israeli policies and practices and personalities are fair game. But what I often find directed against Israel is not mere criticism, it's extremism. You know, questioning the right of the Jewish state to exist, questioning the legitimacy of this Jewish state, holding the Jewish state to double standards. That's not mere criticism, that's extremism. And that's the nuance that the IHRA definition is attempting to capture, however imperfectly. No definition is going to get it perfectly right. But the IHRA definition is a working definition. It is by definition a work in progress, and it's the best we have. I mean, I'll echo what I said earlier. The attempt to offer alternatives is based on a caricature rather than a fair characterization of the IHRA definition. Right. At best, it's based on misunderstanding, and at worst, it's based on willful misrepresentation.
I want to ask more about you now. What was your I'd be curious to know, what was your upbringing like, and why did you choose to get into politics?
The starting point for me is the Bronx. I was born and raised in Bronx, New York, which is one of the poorest counties in America. I spent most of my life in poverty. I was raised by a single mother who had to raise three children on minimum wage, which in the 1990s was $4.25 an hour. And when I won my primary in June of 2020, I publicly said that I would not be where I am today were it not for my mother. That before I was a councilman or a congressman, I'm first and foremost the son of my mother, Deborah Bosselet. And, you know, I have the honor of representing the Bronx, which is full of single mothers like mine, who have struggled and sacrificed and suffered so that their children and grandchildren can have a fighting chance at the American dream. The most formative experience of my life was growing up in public housing, which is owned and operated by the government. And public housing has been so savagely underfunded in New York City that it has a capital need of $40 billion and counting. And so I was one of hundreds of thousands of tenants who had to grow up in conditions of mold and mildew, leaks and lead without consistent heat and hot water in the winter. And I happened to grow up in a public housing development right across the street from the area of Trump Golf Course. And as the golf course was undergoing construction, I kid you not, it unleashed a skunk infestation. So I tell people I've been smelling the stench of Donald Trump well before he became president. But as I saw the conditions in my home get worse every day, the government had invested more than $100 million to construct the golf course for Donald Trump. And I remember wondering at the time, what does it say about our society that we're willing to put more money in a golf course than in the homes of poor people of color in public housing? And so that experience of inequality in the shadow of Trump Golf Course is what inspired me to get my start as a housing organizer. And then eventually I took the leap of faith and ran for public office at age 24. I had no deep pockets, I had no ties to the party machine, but I was an organizer and I spent a whole year doing nothing but knocking on doors. I went into people's homes, I heard their stories. I had voters tell me in the 50 years I've been living here, I've never had a candidate knock on my door. And I won my first campaign on the strength of door-to-door, face-to-face campaigning. I became the first openly LGBTQ elected official from the Bronx. But what's remarkable is that 7 years before that, I was at the lowest point in my life. I dropped out of college because I found myself struggling with depression. I began abusing substances. I thought of taking my own life because I felt as if the world around me had collapsed. I felt a profound sense of failure. And I never thought in my wildest dreams that 7 years later, I would become the youngest elected official in America's largest city, and that today I would be a United States congressman. And so I see my story as a realization of the American dream, and I consider myself the luckiest person on earth.
What concerns are your constituents facing now, more generally?
Well, I represent the Bronx, which is one of the poorest areas in the United States. And so I represent people who are struggling to put food on the table and pay their bills and keep their families afloat. And what weighs most heavily on the people I represent on bread and butter issues of housing, food, education, employment, really the essentials of decent living. And, you know, I represent an area that is struggling to recover from the legacy of COVID. You know, COVID left a death toll in the Bronx of more than 7,000, which is larger than the combined death toll of Pearl Harbor and 9/11. So, you know, to say that COVID was a catastrophe for the Bronx is far from an overstatement. And, you know, I worry in particular about the impact that it's had on the education of children in the Bronx and elsewhere in the world. You know, during COVID, we made a transition from in-person instruction to remote learning. And then we came to realize, or the education establishment came to realize, that not every child had a computer at home. Not every child had access to the internet. And so during COVID, we saw the digital divide deprive students of their fundamental right to an education. And I worry that the loss of learning brought on by COVID will have long and lasting consequences that will endure long after the pandemic is gone. And we're only beginning to come to grips with the impact.
Yeah. Yeah. I think many people might be, you know, wondering, because you've made it to Congress at such a young age. It's a very incredible feat. What can we expect next from you? Are there any higher offices that take your fancy?
You know, I have a rule that I never get ahead of myself.
Okay.
You know, first, I'm grateful to be where I am in life. You know, in a country of 330 million people, I'm one of only 535 members of Congress. You know, to be a member of Congress in the most powerful country in the world, given where I come from, given who I am, is an extraordinary honor and blessing. And my philosophy is that, you know, I'm going to work my heart out at whatever vocation that I'm taking on at a given moment. And I'm hopeful that if I excel, if I govern effectively, and people are going to want me to graduate to the next level, whatever that level might be.
Mm. If someone is visiting New York for the first time, why should they check out the Bronx?
Well, the Bronx is the home of iconic institutions. We have the Bronx Zoo, which is the best of its kind in the world. We have the New York Botanical Gardens, which is the best of its kind in the world. We have the New York Yankees. We have Arthur Avenue, Little Italy, which has some of the best Italian cuisine in the world and has the highest concentration, one of the highest concentrations of small businesses that have been owned by the same family for more than 100 years.
Wow.
And actually, there's a particular one of the oldest businesses on Arthur Avenue is Tidal Brothers. And it's an Italian business, but it's owned by a Jewish family and has been since, I believe, 1915.
Oh, wow.
And there's a story during the 30s and 40s when anti-Semites were burning down Jewish businesses in Europe, the owner of the property that was hosting the Tidal Brothers, the business, advised the family to be in the closet about its Jewish identity. And instead of concealing their Jewish identity, the Tidal Brothers put a Star of David right on the doorstep of their business, which remains there to this day.
I love it.
And every time I come across that Star of David, it is a powerful symbol of integrity and authenticity. It's a powerful example of living your truth. And so I find it inspirational. So the fight against anti-Semitism, in some sense, is encoded in the DNA of Arthur Avenue, Little Italy.
Yeah. Well, that really leads me on to my next question, which I ask all of our guests, which is, if someone who is not Jewish comes to you and says that they want to help in the fight against anti-Semitism, what should they do?
Well, first, you should remember that we all have an obligation to fight extremism, no matter what form it takes. I want to drive home the message that one need not be Jewish to fight anti-Semitism. But in fighting anti-Semitism, it is important to speak to the Jewish community. I think those of us on the outside should never presume to know what is best for the Jewish community. So if the majority of leading Jewish organizations are telling me that the most comprehensive definition of anti-Semitism is IRA, then I'm going to be deferential. I'm not going to presume that I know what's best. I happen to believe that on my own, but you know, who cares what I believe? I care more about what is the leadership of the Jewish community believe. And that warrants deference and respect from allies like myself.
Mm. Yeah, very good. Congressman, please tell the listeners, what have you got going on? What have you got coming up? And where can people find you?
You can find me on Instagram, Twitter, Google, maybe ChatGPT. I am a public figure and I'm hard at work in the United States Congress. You know, I serve on the Committee on Financial Services, which oversees banking and securities and insurance and housing. And I sit on the new Select Committee on Strategic Competition between the United States and China, which examines every dimension of great power competition. So I have my hands full. But I consider myself the luckiest person on earth because I'm a member of Congress in the country that I love.
Fantastic. Congressman Richie Torres, thank you so much for coming on Podcast Against Anti-Semitism.
It was an honor to be here. Take care.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of Podcast Against Anti-Semitism. If you did, please subscribe and leave us a nice rating or email any feedback to podcast@antisemitism.org. Until next Thursday, stay safe.